Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We are one of many, many such lodges situated around the world, and each is autonomous. Each location is an entity, an association unto itself, but each shares in what's called the Declaration of Purposes. Each lodge, as each serious student, is dedicated to studying the philosophy of theosophy, to literally celebrating what the great founders of the theosophical movement have brought forth. And really, at ULT, there's no time for dissensions or side issues or differences of individual opinion, but rather each student affiliated with a particular lodge or perhaps working alone in the field are focused on studying the philosophy so that they can better understand what it is in all its nuances, and with the end result of being able to help and teach others who may themselves be seekers and who may be looking for the truth. In that process of self-study and book study and helping others, what is hoped for is that the principles of the philosophy can be exemplified in daily life, and that in that realization of what daily life can be, each and all come to a better understanding of the true nature of self, and therefore the true essence, the fact, and the truth of universal brotherhood. And so that's the union. That's it. No matter where you would find an association called ULT, you would expect to find that union of the philosophy. There is no organization as such. There isn't anything political or social. There's no contract. There are no bylaws. There's no officers. What happens is each independent student avails themselves of the philosophy and then associates themselves with the cause of keeping a study center open like this one, participating in the volunteer work, either in class or behind the scenes that's necessary. And that basis of universal brotherhood connotes that no one's left out. There are absolutely no energies given to differences of sex or condition or means or background. You would expect to find an array of humanity realizing that universal brotherhood and acting as such. If you're new to the meeting, you can find a periodical in the foyer, and on the back of that you can find a far more beautiful statement of the Declaration than what was just given in summary. But that basically is what ULT in Philadelphia is about. The students associated with Philadelphia efforts are ending the summer session, what's called a light summer session. And so this Sunday, as next Sunday, the doors opened at 10:30, the meeting starts promptly at 11 and lasts until 12. Today, the 22nd, we're looking at healing and magnetism in excerpts of Isis Unveiled by H.P. Blavatsky. Next Sunday, the 29th of September, will be the final investigation of Isis excerpts, and that title for next Sunday morning will be Unity and Nirvana. Also, on Wednesday nights, this building is open, slightly different hours, 5:30, the building opens. There are students available to help anyone who needs to come in and do reference work. You might be preparing for a class, you might be looking into a subject that you heard about in a class, perhaps there's something in life that has piqued your interest or has challenged you in some way and you need to get more information. So from 5:30 to about 7:30, the reference library is open, Straight Line Theosophy. At 7:45, promptly on a Wednesday night, there is another meeting, slightly less formal, in this room. And this coming Wednesday night will be the final September 25th session of the study of the Bhagavad Gita. And so with that, there will be a new periodical issued, and in October we can expect the winter schedule to begin. Wednesdays in the winter, we will be looking at The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, and it should be a very, very good study. Everything you see around you, every aspect of maintaining a very old building, of putting together readings, of helping in the library, anything and everything you can imagine behind the scenes and in public meetings is run on a voluntary basis of a donation of time, service, cash, whatever each individual free thinker wants to bring to the effort. So if you are interested in volunteering or donating in any way imaginable, if you see something that needs to be done that you'd like to help get done, please speak to the person at the book table. Book tables are open during library hours, before and after public meetings. There's always someone there to answer questions. And the promise is that this is a birthright. This philosophy is a birthright to each and all of us. And so the literature that's offered for sale at the table is straight-line theosophy offered at cost, with no profit, no huge profit to be made, just information that you may want to have in your own home. If that does not suit, you can also contact this lodge or the Phoenix Lodge or many others and find the information online as well. It's up to you. Now, without further ado, we're looking at the assignment for today, September 22nd. The subject matter is healing and magnetism, and the study will be one paragraph at a time so that we can go through together and put our minds and hearts together and see what we come up with. We have a first reader who's volunteered.
There is but one magnet in the universe, and from it proceeds the magnetization of everything existent. This magnet is, of course, what the Kabbalists term the central spiritual sun, or God. The sun, moon, planets, and stars, he, Father Kirshner, a monk, Vide Supra, affirmed, are highly magnetic, but they have become so by induction from living in the universal magnetic fluid, the spiritual light. He proves the mysterious sympathy existing between the bodies of the three principal kingdoms of nature and strengthens his argument by a stupendous catalog of instances. Many of these were verified by naturalists, but still more have remained unauthenticated. Therefore, according to the traditional policy and very equivocal logic of our scientists, they are denied. For instance, he shows a difference between mineral magnetism and zoo magnetism or animal magnetism. He demonstrates it in the fact that, except in the case of the lodestone, all the minerals are magnetized by the higher potency, the animal magnetism, while the latter enjoys it as the direct emanation from the first cause, the creator. A needle can be magnetized by simply being held in the hand of a strong-willed man, and amber develops its powers more by the friction of the human hand than by any other object. Therefore, man can impart in his own life, and to a certain degree, animate inorganic objects.
Quite a paragraph. And some of the wording obviously is from the late 19th century, but the concepts are remarkable. Did you come with any insights or observations or yeah?
It looks like the end of the next to the last sentence, it says the direct emanation from the first cause, the creator. So we're looking at like the creator being like universal oversoul, not the deific essence.
the question about first cause and the Creator, there's a theme underlying this, because HPB was actually quoting research done by a man of the world, albeit a monk. He was coming from a particular religious philosophy that she was not. And so there's certain terms running throughout in terms of the term God and Creator. But there is, it is said in the first fundamental of this philosophy, that there is an absolute that is beyond any qualifications or quantifications that we could possibly imagine and bring to it. And that that absolute that includes all else, supports all else, radiates all else, is an abstract force. It is that, but it's without any kind of characteristics. Coming forth in emanation from that absolute is a collective consciousness, is that higher self, that spiritual soul, and in that way involved within that first emanation are all the causations we can imagine, and far more than we can imagine, and that's what creates the circumstances that we have now. There are many different words given to that, but we're thinking of force coming forth from a oneness, and then that force moving periodically by cause and effect, action and reaction. Yes?
You mentioned it because we're not sure if it comes up in the other paragraphs, but we might say in the scientific investigation of the last few hundred years, it is also noticed that electricity can be that higher power that can magnetize any object that it comes in contact with. It can manufacture magnets that way. Motors operate that way. So would there be a connection then between this universal power and what we call electricity?
If there is a oneness in this universal power, this universe that we see in manifestation, then all arrays, all degrees of intelligence or electricity or life force, or spirit, whatever language we use to try to capture that idea, all those gradations are merely a difference of type and kind. They're merely a different reflection of that oneness on a variety of different planes. It is said seven planes. So what we see in our most material world, and that most material world is increasingly non-physical in science and medicine, in astrophysics, we're more and more able to use in a concrete, manufactured machine kind of a way. We're able to generate electricity, we're able to use electricity, we're able to sense the electromagnetics within and about the physical body and the physical brain. We do those things for energy production, we study energy fields, we use energy fields for communication, for cooking, all different kinds of aspects. All of that is electromagnetics, intelligence, in a very concrete kind of a format. This is inviting us to look at the array, that emanation, that degree of intelligence and informing electricity or life force from the very highest, most abstract, most absolute, down to something that emanates from the human and can affect animal, vegetable, and mineral. Yeah.
We didn't follow through looking up the article, but we saw that science is busy investigating some children who attract anything metallic that comes near them. There's a photograph of the little boy covered with spoons.
Oh.
He can't go near anything metal without attracting it. But we think that's more common than science recognizes, people who can't wear a watch because they stop it immediately. So human magnetism doesn't array of scientific study.
Human magnetism is definitely part of the array. It's causing great puzzlement, as it were. And unfortunately or fortunately, there are those souls in incarnation who are now making a buck off these very natural tendencies and talents. They appear on TV or on stage shows doing different things with spoons, bending them, etc., with their bare hands. And there's a lot to be learned. But this was written in the late 1800s when, frankly, the atomic theory was a solid mass. Everything was, from the scientific angle, was very different than it is now. And probably, potentially, you could look up any of these key word terms and come up with remarkable articles. There was a book, The Body Electric, and that's got to be 20 years old by now, isn't it, I think? Written in a very wonderful way, scientifically, very appropriately, you know, in the scientific community, and crossing that line into the non-physical and the potentialities. Even in the late 1800s, this was not new information. She's referring back across time. Again, she is writing as one who collects a bouquet, who has gathered the information from a variety of places, strung it together, and said, this is for you to consider. Yeah.
In the same area, this where it says, he proves of the mysterious sympathy existing between the bodies of the three principal kingdoms of nature. The same connection, would you think?
I'm having trouble finding that sentence.
It's right after the spiritual...
Oh, well, there it is. The mysterious sympathy existing between the bodies of the three principal kingdoms of nature. If there are three bodies of three principal kingdoms of nature, what would they be?
Well, the actual three of nature, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal.
And the animal. A unique degree of intelligence and therefore sensory possibility. But yet there's an empathy. Where do we see in manifestation the most magnetic, empathetic bonding or communion of those three, animal, vegetable, and mineral? Yeah.
In the human form.
In the human form. Absolutely. And whether you're looking at in utero at the human form and that development across all the stages, whether you're thinking about the human body that we're using and what it needs to sustain itself, we're living in a physicality that's actually a communal aspect of those three. And according to this reading from the late 1800s, this has been verified by many naturalists. We don't have to take this at word phrase. We can prove it to ourselves in a number of different ways. Yeah.
And, of course, everyone is familiar with the scientist who was working with some experience that included the use of putting slices of bread. And he noticed that some of the bread had a greenish... and so he had failed in his experiment until he noticed that some of that green mold that got mixed in with some of the other bacteria he was with killed the bacteria.
And the birth of penicillin was upon us.
It looked like mold, but that's what it looked like. But it was certainly more than. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows the effect that is coming in.
Sure, yeah.
Well, it brings to mind then if there is a natural sympathy between the kingdoms, or bodies of the kingdoms, on the reverse, there can also be a natural antipathy. Mm-hmm. How is it possible that one source both the cause of compulsion, dissension, difference, as well as communion, harmony, and brotherhood.
Well, we said at the beginning that abstract, absolute source of all contains everything within it, and it comes forth in emanation. In this plane of matter that we're so aware of, we know, we chuckle about two sides of a coin, two sides of a hand being so entirely different. Magnetism, we know that there's polar opposites in magnetism, positive and negative charge. And so endowed in this spiritual oneness that we all share, there is a possibility of duality, that we can choose to move toward the macrocosm and harmony and a positive use of empathy and sympathy. We can choose and will instead to turn our minds and our natures and our spirits, our heart literally, to the opposite, if we will, to the antipathy, to the separateness, to disharmony, disillusion, if we will. And again, just as it says that, let's see, he demonstrates it in the fact that except in the case of the lodestone, all minerals are magnetized by a higher potency. So everything in the mineral kingdom is dependent upon a next higher state, the animal magnetism, while the latter enjoys it, the magnetization, as a direct emanation from the first cause. If man is a microcosm of that macrocosm, it is resident within our very thought process, the ideation that we hold, that we then use our animal magnetism to affect or influence the lives within the physical body that we're living in and in the world about us. Yeah.
I find it amazing that 150 years ago or so, a man knew about magnetic fluid that permeates all kingdoms of nature, yet today our science hasn't even scratched the iceberg on this topic. But my question is the following. If he knew about the existence of this magnetic fluid that permeates all nature, what is the composition of this magnetic fluid?
Oh, you're asking that question. What is the composition of the magnetic fluid? And resident in that question is the notion of physicality. Can we describe that? Is it a physical something? And if we think back to the word electricity, if we think back to the notion that this is apparently a physical hand, when placed on the physicality of the apparent physicality of this desk, there's an exchange of molecules. There's an exchange of magnetism. Where's the delineation between the hand and the table? And what is it? Can we actually say what that is? Electrical charge, energy source, energy field, spirit. It depends on what kind of words we want to bring to the concept. Yeah.
We're just thinking batteries. We take them out. There's no fluid there, but applied in the right direction, in the right size, you get an electric charge that lasts but a certain mm-hmm. period of time. But we can't understand why that is.
Mm.
Let's just figure out where to place them.
Yeah, there does seem to be some sort of an acid involved in it. I'm not a student of science. We really need to move on time-wise because we have four readings. Perhaps the next paragraph will speak also to the question that was just posed.
Anger, jealousy, friendship, love, and hatred are all modifications of the magnetic atmosphere which is developed in us and constantly emanates from us. Love is one of the most variable, and therefore the aspects of it are numberless. Spiritual love, that of a mother for her child, of an artist for some particular art, love as pure friendship, are purely magnetic manifestations of sympathy in congenial natures. The magnetism of pure love is the originator of every created thing. In its ordinary sense, love between the sexes is electricity, and he calls it amor fibris species, the fever of species. There are two kinds of magnetic attraction, sympathy and fascination, the one holy and natural, the other evil and unnatural. To the latter, fascination, we must attribute the power of the poisonous toad, which upon merely opening its mouth forces the passing reptile or insect to run into it to its destruction. The deer, as well as smaller animals, are attracted by the breath of the boa and are made irresistibly to come within its reach. The electric fish, the torpedo, repels the arm with a shock that for a time benumbs it. To exercise such a power for beneficent purposes, man requires three conditions. One, nobility of soul. Two, strong will and imaginative faculty. Three, a subject weaker than the magnetizer, otherwise he will resist. A man free from worldly incentives and sensuality may cure in such a way the most incurable diseases, and his vision may become clear and prophetic.
Here we have an entire reading on the power of love. And I don't know about you, but this student was thinking, oh, darn it, we're using English. We've got one word for love in all of its manifestations. But here, there's not a thing here that's described in its root source, in its root cause, as anything physical, is there? Just like we know the wind is a reality on this plane, and a tremendous reality for both good and ill, we can't box it, touch it, feel it. It just is. Yeah.
We all know that magnetism in itself is not physical, but one way to demonstrate the magnetism, which is well known, is you take a piece of paper and you put ion files on it, and you hold the magnet, and you can see the magnetic field. And magnets also show if you put two magnets together, depending on which pole is joined. I mean, if you join the positive and the negative, they come together.
Mm.
If you bring the two positives or the two negatives towards each other, they come apart.
Right,
that's
a physical manifestation using the mineral kingdom alone. And this paragraph talks about the power that we can see. If you've ever been in an MRI machine and heard those gigantic magnets clanking away as they're moving and creating a force field for recording. But this says the magnetism of pure love is the originator of every created thing. So beyond what we can see in the force field in a small experiment or in a large manifestation of a machine, this most abstract notion is the originator of every created thing. Yeah.
Yeah, just an observation. We were talking about the sympathies between kingdoms, but even sympathies between people, and the oneness of it. When two people love each other, it's not two loves. It's one
mm-hmm.
love. When 1,000 people operate together, say, in a church, and they love each other, we don't say all of those loves. It's one love. Interesting observation.
That's quite an observation, and if we've been in a high school pep rally or a stadium where there's this amazing array of energy that comes together for an athletic competition, there's a force in the air that's quite remarkable, and that you can really, really sense it. Your hand was up and down.
It ties in with that, though. if you say there's two types of magnetic attraction here, sympathy and fascination, what, how would fascination, the part that is evil and unnatural, show itself in human interactions? What's the difference there?
If there is a fascination, it's a mode almost of a hypnotic effect. One spiritual entity, one human being, is either willing or needing to yield control to another. And therefore, we can observe the mass hypnosis that's created by Madison Avenue, that might be created by a charismatic leader who is using animal magnetism to prey upon the passive, organize all those collective consciousness, and then move them along to a particular very selfish goal. We've certainly got historical examples galore of leaders that are capable of doing that. But there's a fascination. There's something magnetic that the one entity, one human being, is weaker by nature, maybe passive. They've gotten used to daydreaming. They've gotten used to watching TV or swallowing what they read wholesale and not thinking about anything, not criticizing things, not trying to be creative in their thought. And they come across another soul who is in full control of faculties, is very, very able to draw on the animal magnetism, and as in the story of the Emperor Has No Clothes, fascinate an entire population and then lead them astray. So that key here, in terms of sympathy and fascination, one holy and one natural, the other evil and unnatural, we as thinkers sit in, literally, in the communion of all these different faculties and powers, some of which we're not totally aware of, but we're reading about them and learning about them. And we're invited to be as strong in our own character development and our own ethical development so that we're not fascinated, so that we're not passively following something. We're not passively accepting on blind belief anything, but rather we're staying as much in control of our heart and mind as we can. We're attempting to use that field of energy, of generation of energy, for the good, for a universal cause, or for universal goodness, or for on behalf of those around us. And therefore, we're turning our use of whatever forces are at our avail, whether we're conscious of them or not, toward a universal, harmonious, positive thrust, if you will. And that protection, therefore building strength, would then block any fascination. Or if we become enamored for a time, or fascinated, or we would suddenly then become aware, whoa, wait a minute, there's danger here. Yeah.
Well, we would just like to ask the question of the earlier question. Maybe you can tell us, what is the composition of love? And if you can answer that, it answers the other question.
It does. And that's why that statement, the magnetism of pure love is the originator of every created thing. You know, in the very, very ancient literature, there's a phrase that says desire first arose in it. That law, compassion, that what we call tanha in the human condition of the thirst of life has a much higher aspect. So desire first arose in it, but it's not the desire of the feverish flush of romantic love or lust. It's not the desire of attachment to a particular manifestation. It's compassion, a compassionate law of being and doing and creating. Yeah.
Actually, she does say, we think this is what she's saying love is comprised of. It is the purely magnetic manifestations of sympathy in congenial nature.
Mm-hmm.
And congenial nature is plural. So for folks who
expect or hope to see love. They've got to do the work to see the congenial natures of the sympathy within each other, and that'll help to bring about the manifestation of it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense. And
I mean, people who are always bickering in a particular relationship, it's going to be hard to see that magnetic manifestation of congenial natures, and that the nature isn't congenial.
The bickering that occurs in some relationships, thinking back to a maternal aunt and her spouse, push came to shove, that love was incredibly deep and extremely pure. Their home was a foster home for hundreds of infants and adopted children as well. To the strangers that would see the bickering, you'd think, oh gosh, what are they wasting voice and thought on and energy on? And ultimately speaking, that communication process, that teasing process, masked the manifestation of sympathy and congenial natures. At heart, they were one, and it created a very different atmosphere in their home. Yeah.
He's
been called.
I did not hear the name.
Oh, I was referring to a personal anecdote. I'll talk to you later about it. Yeah.
The purely magnetic manifestations of sympathy as being love, those sympathies cannot be of this earth or this substance. They have to be of the nature of soul.
Yes.
Or how else could love or sympathetic attractions bring people back together, life after life, or to similar causes or to similar ideas, if it was purely of this earth?
Yes, and that is stressed at the end of the paragraph. To exercise such a power for beneficent purposes, are we not all here in an attempt to align our lives to do good, to have a purpose for universality? And there are three conditions: nobility of soul, strong will and imaginative faculty, and a subject that we want to help. That we see ourselves as a link in the chain of offering ourselves to be better able to help and teach others. But time is moving on, and we need to move to a third reader.
Happy is the man physically pure, for if his external soul, body, is pure, it will strengthen the second one, astral body, for the soul, which is termed by him the higher mortal soul, which, though liable to err for its own motives, will always side with the reason against the animal proclivities of the body. Every person emits a magnetic exhalation or aura, and a man may be in perfect physical health, but at the same time, his exhalations may have a morbific character for others, sensitive to such subtle influences. Dr. S. Daly and other mesmerists long since taught us that Oriental people, especially the Hindus, are more susceptible than the white-skinned race. Baron Rickenbach's experiment, and, in fact, the world's entire experience, proved that these magnetic accelerations are most intense from the extremities. Therapeutic
manipulations
show this. Handshaking is, therefore, most calculated to communicate antipathetic magnetic conditions, and the Hindus do wisely in keeping their ancient suspicions derived from Manu constantly in mind. Careful physicians wash their hands upon leaving each patient. Why then should they not be charged with superstition as well as the Hindus? The squirrels of disease are invisible, but no less real, as European experiences demonstrate. Well, Oriental experience for 100 centuries has shown that the germs of mortal contagion linger about locations, and impure magnetism can be communicated by the touch.
Now, writing in the late 1800s, when research on germs and the lives that are non-physical, entities that are non-physical and their effect, was not pronounced, was not well known. So that this writing becomes incredibly important in the late 1800s, and as science has continued, medicine has continued in the West, we're beginning to catch up with Eastern teachings. There was a hand way in the back. Yeah.
So is what she's saying here about the impure magnetism can be communicated? So just the fact of going up and shaking hands with somebody,
mm-hmm.
there could be a mixing of the impure and the pure magnetism.
Yeah, there is a practice, and sadly, in the United States, the practice has caused some confusion in cities. I'm thinking of Americans of Korean descent, many of whom are immigrants, who in their businesses, in their shops and stores, may hold with these ancient teachings and therefore want a customer to put money down on the counter and they will make change. Then they put the money down on the counter and then they pick up the customer's money and the customer's to pick up his own. That has caused a lot of hardship with Westerners of all sorts of ethnic and racial descents, because if you think about most stores, there's contact hand-to-hand with cash going back and forth. And to the Westerner, there's no thought given to that. From the Asian philosophy, as exhibited by some of the shopkeepers, it comes across as an aloofness or a racist practice, and it's not that at all. This philosophy is being exemplified. Yeah.
Well, in our country, in modern America at least, when our children go to school from grade kindergarten to about the third grade, they're getting shots given to them, which are not available in many places. These injections protect them from things such as measles.
Well, that's a different study, certainly, and I would invite you all to use the library, the reference library, to look into the nature of inoculations and their effect. State of New Jersey, there's 27 inoculations given before a child is 4 and a half. Yeah.
Regarding the magnetic attraction between the two magnets, modern science has no knowledge of the mechanism of the magnetic attraction. They see the manifestation of the two, but they don't know the mechanism of what's causing the actual attraction. With that said, when the two magnets are attracting each other, I can't say that they're in love. By the same token, when W.Q. Judge spoke about aspects such as telepathy, he referred to the same fohat, or the magnetic fluid of the universe through which telepathy, or by which telepathy, travels. So to me, it seems that there's a distinction between higher aspects of human love and slightly lower yet esoteric or arcane laws of nature, which we do not quite understand, mm-hmm. by which, say, telepathy travels.
Well, so far, in only this reading, you'll notice that in the first paragraph, where it is said that there is but one magnet in the entire universe, and from it proceeds the magnetization of everything else, and it's referred to as central sun, not the sun we see in the sky, but a central sun. If there's that oneness, and then in the second fundamental, we're looking over these other paragraphs where there's cause and effect, an interrelationship of all degrees of intelligence, so that the bones of our body and the micronutrients that we use to regulate our heartbeat, the electrical stimulus in our heart, those are all metals. And earlier in the reading, we were told that metals need to be impressed or influenced by a higher state. So within the human body, as we live in these bodies and we impress the nature of the substances we take in to either strengthen or negate bone, we take in nutrients and electric magnetic vitamins, if you will, in the very fluids of our body to keep the electrical impulses from brain to heart going. All those things are engendered by the compassion or the lack of love that a human mind may entertain as it's using a particular physical form. Yeah.
Okay. I'm just thinking, how could we say that the entire universe, and in particular the human body, isn't a statement of love? Consider that a human body is just this incredible design of all these various organisms doing particularly unique things and yet working together in a sympathetic and cooperative way. If that isn't love, what is?
Yes.
And everyone is familiar with the phrase, it is love that moves the sun and all the stars. And high school students know that particular poem. Who wrote that? So if it moves the sun and all the stars, we have to think about that.
In the world of poetry, in the world of art, in the world of music, as well as in the philosophers that stand behind many of the religions, bubbles up ancient truths, as well as in legends and myths. There's a hand. Yes, sir.
Well, it's given in the first paragraph that we live in the universal magnetic fluid. Now, and then the other paragraph talks about man generating or using that magnetic fluid. Now, the question is there, through living in this magnetic fluid, does man transform it through his body, or does he really just generate it?
Ooh, there is a question. Okay. If, depends on your definition of man or human, doesn't it? If we are soul residing within physicality, so we reside within layers of substance, we reside through astral substance, and there's a lot of testing going on with electromagnetics and lymph systems, portions of the physical body that are not quite physical. And then we reside in the physicality, the force field that we've established. Even if we are unconscious, even if we are in coma, even if we are absolutely, positively paralyzed as physical entities, the thought process, the ideation, the soul is and continues to generate. So it's not of this physical form, it is of something far superior. Yeah.
But we have seven principles, and one of the principles we use is prana.
Yep.
Now, prana, we could say, would be the universal fluid.
Yeah.
So by breathing, question again, are we magnetizing the body through breath, or are we transforming it through our purity of our nature and so forth?
Well, which comes first, spirit or matter? Mind or physicality? So as soul, we live through the mind that is using this physical brain. And the thought that is generated, the motive that is generated, is acting as the magnet, the impress, and the other substances are of a lower nature. You want to share on that same point?
No, I'll do it the previous point.
Okay.
Continue.
Anybody else on the same point? Okay, one more comment, and then we've got to move to the last reading.
Well, it's just that the reference to the white-skinned races that have been observed here in West or in Western civilizations, particularly in America, there's a tremendous melting pot of races, Eastern and Western, of all different varieties. So that must affect the sensitivity as a whole. And whereas we may not be aware of the influence of handshaking, we all know that if we say if somebody gets into our personal space, we immediately feel either an antipathy or a sympathy. Mm-hmm. It's hard to explain, but it's there.
And personal space changes with each culture, so that there's a collectivity of what personal space should be. An interesting avenue of science and research that we could do in the light of theosophy is that of autism, where the sensitivities of the child are so heightened that they cannot respond to human touch at the far end of the spectrum. And again, it's for magnetic reasons. We've got a fourth reader and the...
Another prevalent belief in some parts of Russia, particularly Georgia, Caucasus, and in India, is that in the case the body of a drowned person cannot be otherwise found, if a garment of his be thrown into the water, it will float until directly over the spot and then sink. We have even seen the experiment successfully tried with a sacred cord of a Brahmin. It floated hither and thither, circling about as though in search of something, until suddenly darting in a straight line for about 50 yards, it sank, and at that exact spot, the divers brought up the bottom. We find this superstition even in America. A Pittsburgh paper of very recent date describes the finding of a body of a young boy named Reed in the Monongahela by a like method. All other means having failed, it says, a curious superstition was employed. One of the boy's shirts was thrown into the river where he had gone down and, it is said, floated on the surface for a time and finally settled to the bottom at a certain place, which proved to be the resting place of the body and which was then drawn out. The belief that the shirt of a drowned person when thrown into the water will follow the body is well spread, absurd as it appears. This phenomenon is explained by the law of the powerful attraction existing between the human body and objects that have been long worn upon it. The oldest garment is most effective for that experiment. A new one is necessary.
And so we have a statement of the actual influence of the mind or soul entity residing in a physical body, impressing not only the lives of the physical body, but those lives used as well. Yeah.
So what does it? So when we go, if we buy clothes at a thrift shop or a flea market,
I'm laughing because that was my first thought when I started looking at this part.
Just washing it a number of times, is that good enough or what?
Well, apparently not. If the shirt can float down the Monongahela, the water did not affect the magnetism. But aren't we drawn to certain, walking into a consignment shop or a department store, aren't we drawn to particular items immediately? And there's much of life impressed in that item. Where was the item made? By whom was it made? And if it is used, then, oh my goodness, what's the effect of that? And how many of us were raised with hand-me-downs, or when an elder in the family passed, the family lined up, hoping to get just the right object that soul had used in life because of the vibrations, we say, on the object. Your hand went up.
My grandfather was a Freemason, and I would wear his, and
inoperable old Masonic watch, because I knew that if I wore my grandfather's watch that I knew he always wore it, he passed, and he gave me things in as well. And I wore this watch sometimes when I needed him, you know, and where that watch had been at these lodges. But I'm kind of a believer in Native American smudging, where you
yes.
take cedar, I'm mixing my words up with the letters, sage, cedar, and sweetgrass. And if you want to cleanse, you would take sage and you would burn it. People say, I smell marijuana. Well, you don't know anything about Native American spirituality. This is not marijuana, this is sage. But we would cleanse my apartment when I first moved in, or whatever, you know, with a feather, and then cleanse each other's borders. And that's all I have to say today.
So there are many cultures, including the Native American, and many indigenous cultures that operate very closely on these concepts. Yeah.
Well, I definitely think one should be more concerned about what they eat, because the person who is preparing the food, their feeling, their emotion goes into it. So one should know the state of the person who prepared your meal, or you shouldn't take it.
And therein, in that comment, lies a great situation. We live in a very complex Western society with very specialized tasks for producing objects and things and food and clothing and whatnot. Walking into this room, we exchange energies of all kind. We had an earlier comment about the nature of prana and how it's generated or influenced or whatever. There is a statement in the philosophy that the fullness of the seeming void, that there is no point of intelligence, there is no point of place or time that is not energized and impacted. And so as we begin to wonder, oh, what about I want to inherit such and such from so-and-so in the family, or should I continue to practice the green philosophy of shopping and consignment shops, or I better prepare only the food I eat and never mind who's preparing what. What we then need to sit in contemplation over is, what's my motive in the moment in that thinking? And is that thinking separatist? I'm better than that. I might be in some way impacted by negative karma by that practice. Or is the thinking, I am one with all. This is a universe of harmony and unity. And if I dwell on the nature of the energy and the force of love and compassion and sharing and understanding, can I trust karma to bring me the circumstances that I need to think and to grow and progress? Yeah.
This brings up the question, should I be concerned that my heart or my lungs or my kidneys have been transplanted from someone else to save my life? Is there a particular influence that I will have to overcome? Or am I looking at this wrong?
You know, there's a very good point, and there are many folks that come into the reference library to do private study on just that angle. What is there in the philosophy about transplant, about transfusion of blood, and what happens with the essence of the magnetism when there an organ is taken from one human being and placed in another, or the early pig valves, where a pig valve was taken out of an innocent animal and placed in the chest of a human to replace the microvalve. If that magnetic field that karmically we come in with, we are born as soul, taking on veils of skin, taking on veils of those seven substances, as we come in karmically into this life, we are operating on skandhas, tendencies, magnetic attractions, energy force fields that we've set up in past lives. And we've attracted substance and attracted talents and attracted the karma that the soul needs on this plane to learn to be better able to help and teach others. If we begin to finagle with those instruments, if we begin to add the magnetism from another human being or from an animal in some way, what do we do to the purity of the magnetism and the electricity and the life force that we're using, that karmically we're meant to use? Big questions, and there's plenty of information in readings in Straight Line Theosophy for any soul that wants to give serious consideration to that. We never know when medical circumstances are going to change and what the conditions will be. We're just about out of time, and we're reminded that in a very, very ancient treatise, even far more ancient than the American Native culture, in the Gita, there appears this statement: as a single sun illuminateth the entire world, even so doth the one spirit illumine every body. So as there is a central sun that illuminates everything that we can imagine in manifestation, there is a one spirit that illumines every body, every single human body, every single animal, vegetable, mineral, any form we can imagine. There is but one behind all. Have a great week. And remember that the final Gita class is Wednesday night. Oh, there was a little red light the whole time. I hope it worked.
Yeah. Yeah, I did.